Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm Hugh LaFollette, Professor of Philosophy at East Tennessee State University. My guest this morning is Lynn Pascarella, Chair of the Department of Philosophy at the University of Rhode Island. And our topic is Making Hard Times Even Harder. Lynn, glad to have you on the show.
Thanks.
There's a growing mood in the country that we need to get tough with criminals. And among other things, this shapes the way we treat criminals once they get into the criminal justice system. Could you briefly describe the changes that have occurred and those that have been proposed for changes for the treatment of prisoners within the system?
Sure. Recently, there have been two types of proposals to change conditions for prisoners. The first type of proposal deals with sentencing reform, and the second deals with conditions of confinement themselves. In the first category are proposals to get tough on crime by instituting harsher mandatory minimum penalties and three strikes laws that would require sentences of 25 years to life for anyone convicted of more than two violent felonies. Along with those attempts to implement harsher sentences, there have been efforts to make prisons a kind of place that you really don't want to go. So legislatures in several states have introduced bills that would create no-frills prisons. And that means that inmates would be forbidden from having access to televisions and computers, air conditioners, weight training rooms. And then other states have gone further, and they've tried to reinstate hard labor and chain gangs. Finally, there are some states that have tried to make inmates pay for their own medical care and have banned payment for college tuition. And then finally, there are states who that are trying to keep inmates in complete isolation. So for instance, in Oklahoma, if you're on death row, you're going to spend 23 hours of every day in isolation, in a concrete cell with no sunlight, and you're not going to have any physical contact with visitors or guards. So there are a wide range of proposals, and they fall into those two categories.
Okay, what's the reason for this get-tough approach toward criminals?
Well, I think the trend signifies a good deal of fear and disillusionment. While the crime rate has remained relatively stable, and in fact has dropped recently to the lowest point that it's been in 25 years, there's a rise in public fear and outrage at the nature and frequency of violent crime. Now, I'm not sure what fuels that perception, but I think part of it is the media. If we think about recent cases, the most brutal and shocking cases are reported on the evening news, and then they're replayed over and over again on all of the news talk shows. And we hear the 911 tapes, and we hear and see interviews with grieving relatives. And so the most horrific cases are relived for us in a very real way. So I think we're bound to feel vulnerable, even if we're less vulnerable than we used to be. And then this sense of fear is accompanied by a sense that justice isn't really being done. There have been some highly publicized cases where we think that perhaps people have gotten away with murder or at least didn't get the punishment that they deserved. So I think that contributes to this trend toward harsher punishment.
All right, now, I take it that you understand that motivation. You understand the fear. You understand the fact that people want to feel safe. You understand maybe even this desire to make sure that people get punished for crimes they commit. Yet I take it that you have some real misgivings about these tendencies within the criminal justice system. Briefly explain what those are, and then we could maybe go back and look at the various points in more detail.
Sure. I think, first of all, there's no evidence that these sorts of policies will achieve the stated purpose that they have of reduced recidivism. In fact, I think there's reason to believe that the objective of reduced recidivism will be thwarted if we continue with this trend of making prison conditions harsher.
Actually, I hate to interrupt, but could you explain what recidivism is? Some listeners may not understand.
Sure. Recidivism is the criminal returning to prison after being released. So crimes continuing to be committed after the person is released from the prison system. So that's one of the reasons that we've taken this get tough attitude. We want to reduce the crime rate. I'm not sure that's going to happen by implementing the sorts of measures that have been proposed. And secondly, I think the theories of punishment to which the advocates of these policies appeal don't do the work of justifying the policies. And so I have both practical and theoretical reasons why I'm opposed to the kinds of policies that are being implemented.
All right. Well, could you elaborate a bit on the practical reasons you're opposed to the policy? In particular, you seem to want to say that it's not going to have the effect that people want it to have. Could you explain that?
Sure. If we abandon the rehabilitative ideal that we adopted in the 60s and we push toward making prison conditions harsher without any consideration of the fact that people are going to be released, then we're likely to turn out criminals with no skills who are in exactly the same position that they were in before. And they're going to be angry, and I think it's more likely that they're going to end up back in prison. And what's the alternative? So if we're not providing them with the means to change their lives through rehabilitation, and we are taking away those mechanisms that would provide for some skills acquisition or some control within the prison system, then I don't know how we would expect that things would get better.
Okay, would this be an example of the public sort of trying to achieve a certain goal, taking a certain policy, and in fact adopting a policy that works against the very goal that they're trying to achieve?
Right. So some people say, you know, these sorts of individuals who commit the most heinous crimes are animals, and they deserve to be treated like animals. But if we do that, then we're going to be releasing animals out onto the street. So if we haven't paid attention to the fact that maybe the people who are acting in these ways haven't been given the sorts of social support that they needed to live in a civil society, and we don't make any effort to provide them with what they need in order to develop a psychological or social skills to integrate into society, then really haven't done anything except fulfill our basic desire for vengeance.
Okay, well, actually, this provides us a way. Ultimately, we may want to come back and discuss it some more, but this provides us a way to get into the more theoretical considerations you mentioned. I can imagine a listener who adopts the Get Tough strategy that we're discussing here wanting to respond to you in two different ways. I can imagine the listener saying, on the one hand, that look, these people are animals, and they need to be treated like animals. They've done something horrible, and we need to treat them in accordance with what they've done, in proportional to the wrong they've done. And if we don't do that, we're not dispensing justice. And then I can also imagine someone else saying that if we don't do that, we're not going to have any form of effective deterrence, which gets us again to the more theoretical considerations you mentioned earlier. So would you like to maybe elaborate on those and talk about the more theoretical considerations?
Yeah. Well, I think when society uses punishment, that act of punishment needs to be justified. And the reason is this, that punishment by its very nature involves the intentional infliction of pain on the criminal, the wrongdoer, by the state. And we authorize the state to act on our behalf to see that justice is served. But because the act of punishment entails that imposition of suffering through the loss of liberty and sometimes life, if we're talking about capital punishment, and these are acts that are themselves ordinarily considered to be wrong, we need to be able to justify this otherwise wrong act. And that's where theories of punishment come in. And the two concerns that you just mentioned are actually the basis of two related theories of punishment. On the one hand, there are people who are retributivists or retributionists, and they appeal to two basic principles. One is the principle of desert, that people should be punished because they deserve to be punished. And there's the understanding that they should be punished if and only if they deserve to be punished. And then there's an appeal to the principle of proportionality, that the punishment should fit the crime. We should punish people more severely if they've committed more serious crimes, and less severely if they've considered less serious crimes. So that's one approach to punishment. The second approach is a utilitarian approach. And utilitarians assume that because punishment is going to involve this infliction of suffering on an individual, and utilitarians look at the rightness and wrongness of acts in terms of the pleasure or happiness or pain or displeasure that's brought about by the acts. And they consider an act to be right if and only if it produces the greatest good, meaning pleasure or happiness for everybody involved. There has to be some social value that's brought about by the punishment that's going to override the displeasure or unhappiness that we're bringing to the criminal offender. And for the utilitarian, this social value can be seen in terms of the deterrent effects, the prevention or incapacitation of the criminal from committing further crimes, and through rehabilitation. So those are three goals that the utilitarian has. So those are the two theories of punishment that could be used to justify these hardline approaches that we've taken recently.
Okay, but I take it, let's look at the first one, the idea of retribution. The person who adopts a theory of retribution says that these people have broken the law, they've gone against the good of society, they've harmed particular individuals, and therefore they deserve to be punished for what they've done, and moreover they need to be punished in a way that is proportional to the crime that they have committed. What's wrong with that?
Well, the retributivists are assuming that we live in a kind of ideal society where everyone benefits equally in the society. The assumption is that the criminal wrongdoer has benefited doubly by failing to comply with the rules of society. The criminal has become a free rider and gained an unfair advantage. Now, we give up our freedom in order to live in a civil society. So there's a burden placed on me and that I can't do whatever I want. And by accepting that burden, I gain the protection from society of living in a civil society. So the state is going to protect me from preventable harm. What's wrong with the assumption that everyone benefits equally, and so everyone has an equal duty to comply with the rules of society, is that it's just not true. Not everybody gains the benefits of living in a civil society. In fact, some people are substantially burdened. If you think of poor urban areas where people are living in extreme poverty and violence. They don't have a lot of police protection. They don't have access to health care. I think those people would be hard-pressed to identify the benefits that they've reaped from living in a civil society. And so to assume that they have the same sorts of obligations to comply with the law is wrong-headed. Now, I don't think that we want to take the approach, I don't think we should take the approach that they bear no responsibility for their actions. But I think the responsibility is tempered by our failure to provide them with equal protection to the law.
All right, let me stop just for a second for the benefit of anyone who may be tuning in late. My guest today on Ideas and Issues is Lynn Pascarella, Chair of the Department of Philosophy at the University of Rhode Island, and our topic is Making Hard Times Even Harder. On the last point, it seems to me that's an interesting point. I want to try the following analogy and see if it helps. If we think about people as participating in a game where the rules are fair and everyone has equally a fair chance to compete in the game. Then if one person breaks the rules, we feel justified in punishing them for breaking the rules.
Mm-hmm.
But if the competition and the benefits are not fair from the beginning, then although we may punish them, the person who has been severely disadvantaged is not as much to blame, perhaps, as someone who's been able to reap the benefits of a competition. Would that be roughly right?
I think that's right.
Okay. All right, well, let's move to the second half of what you're talking about, the idea that of the utilitarian punishment, that what we want to do is establish a system that is going to deter other people from committing a crime, the same crime. The idea is you use the person who's being punished as an example so that other people can do it. And also the idea that, which you discussed briefly earlier, that by having harsh punishment, once people are released, they're less likely to commit the crime again. Now, maybe we ought to focus on the first, since you've mentioned the second earlier. What about this idea of deterrence?
Mm.
An individual says harsh punishments do deter, and so therefore we need to use them.
Yeah, there isn't any evidence in support of the claim that harsh punishments actually do deter. In fact, there's evidence that no matter how harsh the punishments are, if the economic circumstances are right, then there aren't going to be any deterrent effects of harsh punishment. There are studies suggesting that criminals just don't think about the consequences beforehand. And if they do, then they think that they're not going to get caught. And so punishment can't serve as a deterrent because the people engaging in criminal acts don't have realistic expectations about what's going to happen to them. And even for those who do, I mean, there are some criminals and some sorts of crimes that have a very high recidivism rate, and there's an extreme likelihood that the people are going to get caught. Even for those people, the risks associated with getting caught are always going to be outweighed by the benefits, because crime pays for them. And so deterrence as a principle makes sense only in the context of a social system where we provide economic opportunity. There's some alternative and some meaningful alternative to criminal activity. If you have nothing to lose, then punishment, no matter how harsh, can serve as a sufficient deterrent. So I think that's one of the problems with the theory of deterrence in contemporary society.
Well, now, theoretically that makes sense, but I can also imagine someone taking the claim you made earlier. You noted earlier that the violent crime rate is the lowest now than it's been in 25 years. And I can imagine someone who defends the current practices saying, see, I told you. We've got tough, crime rate's gone down.
Yes. And it's very difficult to make those connections between factors like harsher prison conditions and decreased crime rate. It's not clear, but I don't think that we should count on the fact that prison conditions have gotten harsher as the source of a decreased crime rate. I think it's more likely to be the case, sociologists, criminologists will appeal most frequently to changing demographics and the fact that the baby boomers have gone through their 20s, and so crime rate is most often most closely tied to age. And there are other factors. The economy is a factor. And incapacitation is as well. So I don't think we can ignore the fact that we have taken this approach toward mandatory minimum sentences and three-time loser laws. I think that has increased incapacitation of criminals, and that may indeed have decreased the crime rate. But we also have to take into account the consequences of those policies in the future.
Okay, well, actually, we can put two things together. You said two, which would seem to support the second claim you made. You were arguing earlier that until we reach the place where we have a just economic order, where people have a chance to get a job, have good medical care, are themselves protected from crime, that there will always be some motivations for crime. And the assumption seemed to be that as economic conditions improved, crime might decrease. And one of the things that we've also seen in the past 5 to 6 years, the same time period in which crime rate has gone down, is that in general the economic outlook seems to be a bit better. Unemployment, for example, I believe it's at its lowest in the past 10 or 15 years.
Right.
All right. Now, a slightly different question, but certainly related to this. Lurking in the background of a number of your comments seems to be the suggestion that it's not just counter to considerations of deterrence. It's not just that we, being harsh, will make recidivism more likely. Lurking in the background seems to be a view that somehow as civilized people, there are just certain sorts of punishments we shouldn't inflict on people, no matter what their crime. Am I right? Is that in the background?
Yes, it is. I think even if we take the most extreme position that a criminal forfeits all of his or her rights upon committing a crime, that we still have a duty to treat individuals in society, especially individuals under our care, humanely. And that's going to prohibit us from enacting some of the policies that have been proposed.
Well, why is that? I can imagine someone saying, but look, these are criminals after all. Why do we have to treat them humanely? They've not treated us humanely.
One reason is that if we believe that we are better moral agents, then I think it's incumbent upon us to provide moral role models for those we are incarcerating and who are, in fact, under our care.
Okay, and that's going to put limits on what we could and should do to them.
Yes.
Okay. Now, we've got about 5 minutes left here. I'd like to move in a slightly different direction. You've pointed out what you take to be certain limitations of the retributive model of punishment. You pointed out certain limitations of what you take to be the utilitarian model of punishment. That might seem to suggest that you think that somehow punishment is totally inappropriate. There's no good model of punishment. Is that what you think?
No, I think that punishment can be justified by appeal to both retributivism and utilitarianism. I think that there are people who deserve to be punished, and they should be punished in proportion to the severity of the crime. So I adhere to the retributivist model. I also want to appeal to the utilitarian's emphasis on rehabilitation. So I think that when we give people what they deserve, that we also ought to keep in mind the goals of rehabilitation, and that our response to criminals ought to be tempered by a sense of mercy. And I think that too often we don't take that into account. So my response is that I do think that punishment can be justified. But I would like to shift away from the focus on vengeance and move more toward restraint and compassion.
Okay, well, I know in your written work, too, you've emphasized the idea of restorative justice. Could you explain what that means and how that would augment what you just said?
Sure. Restorative justice assumes that the criminal wrongdoer has responsibility for restoring an equilibrium in a system that has been injured through the criminal's behavior. And there are some models in place where countries have tried to implement a system of restorative justice. New Zealand and Australia are now implementing policies that allow for the criminals to get together with victims and the victims' families and talk about how to restore this moral balance. And I think that those are valuable models, and I would like to see us move in that direction where we take into account alternatives for nonviolent offenders, alternatives in the form of drug treatment programs and vocational programs that would allow prisoners to meet the costs of incarceration through meaningful job training. And at the same time, this would help them to stay out of prison. So it would achieve some of the goals underlying the proposals that we've seen to make hard times harder, but do so in a way that allows victims to have a primary voice in determining the punishment.
Okay, but it's not necessarily letting victims determine the punishment in the sense of saying, lock them up, beat them daily, but that by somehow interacting with the criminal, that this could be psychologically healing both to the victim and to the criminal.
Yes, there's a component of moral education, and the system that's been established in New Zealand and Australia employs diversionary conferencing. And what that means is that there are conversations that take place that would divert the criminal from ending up in the court system. So that it's similar to mediation in divorce cases where you don't get the lawyers involved, you don't go through the court system. You try to talk about how the criminal could pay back society without going to prison.
Okay. Well, we've got just a little over a minute now. I wonder if you could briefly summarize if the sort of one thing you would like the listener to think about when they think about the Get Tough policy, what would be your basic message?
Well, it's a message that enjoins people to be cautious in what they're proposing. When we increase the number of prisoners and we take this hardline approach, we promote conditions in prison that are unsafe not only for the people who are the criminal wrongdoers, for the people in prison, but for the prison staff, for the correctional officers, and for those outside when the criminals are released. And so I think that I understand the fear and apprehension that people have in living in a society where there does seem to be extreme violence, but we need to be cautious and take into account our responsibilities as citizens in a civil society.
Okay, well, thank you very much for appearing on the show.
Thank you.
I've been talking today with Lynn Pascarella, Chair of the Department of Philosophy at the University of Rhode Island. This is Eula Follett, Fridays and Issues. Good day.